without clarity on the decision-making role, it's very hard to make decisions. And you tend inevitably to end up with what I would call lowest common denominator outcomes, right? And I think that's what we've seen in the climate COPs. We see lowest common denominator outcomes, COP after COP after COP.
Welcome to Plastisphere, the podcast on plastics, people, the planet, and politics. My name is Anja Krieger. This year, we focus on the negotiations for the Global Plastics Treaty. At the moment, they are haunted by some major issues that have long stalled progress on other problems as well, like climate change and biodiversity loss. To understand what's happening, I teamed up with Magnus Lowold, an expert in diplomacy and international law. Magnus was present at all the meetings of the Intergovernmental Negotiation Committee for the Plastics Treaty, the so-called INC. When I followed the INCs from afar, his blogs popped up in my feed and helped me understand the negotiations so much better. I really love his witty and smart writing, which you find on Points of Order, his blog on Medium. Now, I thought you'd enjoy his accounts as well, so here comes the second part of our recap of plastic diplomacy. We'll travel to Paris in the summer of 2023, where the second negotiating meeting took place. If you haven't listened to our recap of the first INC in Uruguay, I recommend you go back an episode and start listening there. At the end of the last episode, we discussed the potential options paper, basically a list of ideas to tackle plastic pollution. But Magnus had a bunch of doubts about it. He said it included everything you could think of: reducing plastic production, regulating materials, products, chemicals, waste management, and cleanup. But it didn't represent a coherent and binding plan.
And so I felt when reading it that it didn't really provide a committee with the kind of clarity that it needed to enter into a more substantive discussion at the next INC in Paris.
That leads us to Paris. And there was quite some drama even ahead of time, right? Tell us more about what happened there.
Yeah, so the Paris session of the plastic pollution negotiations, what we call the INC 2, was a very difficult session. And I think that's where many sort of had expected and hoped that this now negotiations will really start. Now we will start negotiating the actual substantive content and we will, you know, get down to business a little bit, get down from this very general level where we were in Uruguay and sort of actually start negotiating what this treaty should do. And in the run-up to the meeting, it already started, you know, a few weeks before with some problems because this meeting would take place in the UNESCO headquarters in Paris. And it turned out that UNESCO headquarters had quite limited space capacity. And of course, interest in this process, it has grown and it continues to grow. And there were so many that had a stake in this process that wished to attend. And then it turned out that there were some significant space limitations there and that maybe, you know, many civil society organizations, they would basically not be allowed access into the room. So that sort of set the stage for a little bit sort of a bad start for this meeting. But, you know, the meeting started and they accepted the ones that they could accept. And then when it opened very sort of grandiose with it was a video statement by the president of the French Republic, Emmanuel Macron, talking about his visions for this treaty and what he thinks it should contain. I was there in the room and I remember, this feels important. Now I feel like this week we're going to be able to see something important happen and that we're going to get a direction to these negotiations. And we need that now because there's not that many sessions to negotiate this treaty. But then almost immediately when the session sort of really started and it came to the question of adopting these rules of procedures where the chair, you know, I told you he had promised to conduct informal consultations to resolve the issue, these brackets in Rule 37. And then he just reported that he had made no progress on that. So he just suggests that, you know, we continue to provisionally apply the rules of procedure and then we basically move on and I continue consultations. Now, some countries, they were not happy with that. And they had been preparing to actually object to this provisional application of the rules procedure and particularly to prevent any voting on substantive matters taking place. So this was sort of, they had prepared to do that. And it was really exacerbated by the fact that at the INC2, the committee had to elect its so-called bureau. So a bureau of a committee is a group of representatives of countries that have been elected to sort of coordinate the committee's work. So it's the chair and, you know, a few others. It can vary in size. I don't remember exactly how many bureau members there are in this committee, but I think it's about nine or something. It's a fairly small group. And in the bureau, in, you know, it's the regions like the Western European and Others group, or the Latin American and the Caribbean group, or the African group, or the Asia Pacific group. They all sort of coordinate internally, and they come to, okay, we're going to propose these two candidates from our region to the bureau, and normally that's totally fine, right? But then the problem was that in the Eastern European group, you have both Russia and Ukraine as a part of that group. And of course, we know that there is currently a war in Ukraine as a result of Russia's invasion of that country. So we know that atmosphere in the Eastern European group is not great at the moment. As a result, they had not been able to agree on a set of candidates. And we knew then that the only way to actually constitute a bureau was to go to elections, you know, taken by a vote. Now, this is a procedural matter. It's not a substantive matter. But still, a lot of countries felt then, okay, we're deeply uncomfortable about this. And they, you know, already started to request so-called assurances from the chair that, you know, this vote on the bureau election, that would be constitute an exceptional circumstance, that would not happen again. We're just doing this because we absolutely have to. It became a lot of discussion about that. And there were even countries that were questioning, how can you do this since we haven't adopted the rules of procedure, which of course stipulates how bureaus should be elected? What does provisional application of rules of procedure really mean? What's the legal implications of that? A lot of questions, a lot of back and forth. And I don't think that the chair or the secretariat were really prepared for that kind of, to have that kind of discussion. But that discussion occurred. Now, they did manage to, in the end, have these bureau elections. They sort of accepted it's a procedural matter. So they spent quite a lot of time to organize these elections. But then the next item on the agenda was the adoption of the rules procedure, because since they hadn't been adopted, they also have to formally put it on the agenda. The chair came to that, and he again said, you know, I suggest that we provisionally apply these rules. That led to a big debate, and it took days to resolve, right? And the meeting was only 5 days, so you didn't have that much, and it was supposed to be a negotiation on substance, right? But instead, the committee was sort of embroiled in this discussion about decision-making rule. And in the end, after a lot of debate and a lot of back and forth, they did manage to agree on a so-called interpretative statement on the application of the decision-making rule. And that is that interpretive statement basically just, it makes the whole issue very ambiguous. It just notes that there is this differing views on the decision-making rule in the committee. And then it also suggests that if it ever comes to actually enforcing the decision-making rule, meaning that if someone ever calls on for a vote on substantive matters, this disagreement should be recalled. It's all very vague. It's a masterful display of what is sometimes called constructive ambiguity, because they agreed to disagree and they put that down in a text that they decided on. Like, we agreed to disagree on this to enable us to move forward. So in that sense, it did a trick. It did enable the committee at long last, more than halfway through that session, to actually start discussion about the substance of the treaty and discussing the content of this potential options paper. But of course, a lot of time had been wasted. And of course, it didn't really resolve the issue. It fudged the issue. It was even less clear after that exactly what kind of decision-making rule the committee was operating under. Could it go to a vote if, you know, need be, as a last resort? Well, some countries still believe that that was still a legal option, while others made it very clear that, you know, in light of this statement, we can't vote. Everything needs to be decided by consensus. So, you know, nothing was resolved. It was just sort of, the whole issue was kicked down the road and deferred. It enabled the committee to move on and continue to discuss substance. But of course, it also introduced a major risk to the process. Like, if it ever came to a point where decisions have to be made, and at one point, decisions will have to be made in this committee, and, you know, this will come up again. And it it was very unclear how it would be resolved. So it was big drama. And I think a lot of the observers were like, what is happening here? I thought we were at a meeting where people are supposed to, or states are supposed to discuss the content of a treaty on plastic pollution. And instead, they're spending so much time talking about decision making and rules of procedure. And I think I found it also sort of frustrating, but also I think it's very important, because at the end of the day, without an effective decision making role in this committee, it's very hard for me to see how these negotiations will end up with anything close to an effective treaty. So for me, it was very concerning in a sense that they fudged the issue even more, and that there was so strong opposition to the rule that had been, you know, developed already in Dakar a year earlier, and that there had been agreed, and they were sort of reopening this issue in an effort to maybe for some countries just to delay the process.
Then maybe your blog post title confused me a little bit. I think you talked about the success of the magical ministry of diplomacy or something like that.
Exactly. So I had a blog post which was titled, I think, Report from the Ministry of Magical Affairs. And I think it was just, I thought about Harry Potter and I just, you know, that was the inspiration. No, so it's, you know, the interpretive statement, it was about that, like that it seems like they were agreeing because they were able to make a decision and they were able to move forward. So it sort of creates this impression of agreement in the committee, but actually it just hides a reality of fundamental disagreement about the rules of the game, right? The rules of the committee. So in that sense, it was a little bit like magic.
Since you initially came in with this hope that this treaty process would turn out to be like an example or set a successful example showing that international treaties can work, were you still optimistic, or could you regain your optimism after that?
Well, yeah, I think in a sense, I think that this debate and this issue would come up. It was inevitable. And we have seen that decision-making in multilateral arenas, it's been a contentious issue for many years, right? As an example, on climate change, the UNFCCC, they have their conference of parties, right? And if you look into the rules of procedure to the UNFCCC, you will notice that they haven't been able to agree on their decision-making rule. That's actually in brackets. So that means that there's no agreement on how the UNFCCC or the parties to the UNFCCC should make its decisions. And that's been since, I think, 1996. And every COP since then has just deferred the issue, kicked it down the road. And I think, you know, this is an example of, you know, people ask, why aren't there more progress on, you know, international climate governance? And I think this is a big part of the reason, because without clarity on the decision-making role, it's very hard to make decisions. And you tend inevitably to end up with what I would call lowest common denominator outcomes, right? And I think that's what we've seen in the climate COPs. We see lowest common denominator outcomes COP after COP after COP. And the reason is that there is no voting option in the rules of procedure to the UNFCCC. So I think this has been a problem in some multilateral environmental agreements for some time. Of course, now we're talking about treaty negotiations. We're not talking about a established treaty with conference of parties and the rules of procedure of that. And I think that's, in a sense, more concerning that there are brackets in the rules of a negotiation committee, because there's no precedent for that, never seen that before. But so this is, it's a bit of a problem that has been, you know, there in other treaties, and it's been around for some time. And I think that we need to resolve this. If we're going to have any chance of actually addressing the challenges and the problems that the UNFCCC and, you know, the Paris Agreement, the sub-agreements under that are seeking to address, climate change, or if we're going to have any chance of resolving the problems that the Convention on Biological Diversity is trying to address, there needs to be a possibility of a large majority of countries coming together and forcing decisions through a vote as a last resort if consensus cannot be reached. And I see this plastics treaty process that we're now involved in as an example where actually it's possible to have that debate about rules of procedure, to have that debate about decision-making rule, and that debate actually ending with countries deciding, no, actually we do want to have the option as a last resort of taking substantive matters to a vote. So if we win this, if we're able to argue convincingly for the need for a majority decision-making as a last resort on plastic pollution, then that will also set a precedent and inspire similar kind of decisions, I believe, on climate change and on biological diversity, and indeed on also other sort of problems of global concern. So that's why, you know, although it's frustrating when these issues come up, I think it was inevitable. And I think the fact that it came up gave the countries that really want to solve this problem and want to solve other environmental problems an opportunity to sharpen their arguments and push this through. Because the good news is that there is actually a large majority of countries that wants to have decision-making rule allowing for voting as a last resort. We saw that in Paris. There's a small, fairly small group of countries like China, like India, like Brazil, for instance, advocating for consensus. But the vast majority of countries, they would like decisions to be made by a vote as a last resort. That is very encouraging. And I think the challenge now after Paris is to really try to prop up, in a sense, and encourage and inspire these countries to really force a decision through on this. They can do it. There is a procedural path for it, but it requires a little bit of courage, because I think they just need to realize that what they're doing here will not just have an impact on this treaty, but it will have an impact on the regulation of other environmental issues as well.
I love your optimism. Now, there's a third meeting that we haven't talked about, the INC3 in the winter of 2023 in Nairobi, Kenya.
There was some excitement around, okay, finally, we're going somewhere. We have a zero draft. We have some legal text. This could actually, you know, end up as a treaty. It was possible to see how this could, you know, end up as a treaty that could be adopted. It was sort of an optimistic, I think, attitude at the beginning, sort of great hopes that this would, you know, finally lead somewhere.
That's up next time on Plastisphere. Join me and Magnus for the third round of our recap to learn what happened in Kenya. If you liked this episode, please rate and review the podcast online and tell your friends about it. This is an independent show. I currently have no financial backer, pay all costs out of my own pocket, and produce the program in my spare time. So to support new episodes and help me continue this project, please go to plastisphere.earth/support. Thanks for listening, and see you next time.